Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pace. Tonight I'm speaking with best-selling author and Oakland native Tommy Orange. In his 2018 debut novel, There, There, Tommy Orange explains the lives of urban Native Americans, stories and perspectives that have historically been underrepresented in our literature. Rather than trying to convey the Oakland urban Native experience from one point of view, Orange introduces 12 narrators and describes their individual struggles with identity and authenticity, tradition and modernity, asking, what does it mean to be Native today? Native today, and named was one of New York Times' 10 best books of the year in 2018 and the recipient of multiple awards, There, There has been praised for portraying the urban Native experience and navigating complex themes such as addiction, abuse, depression, suicide, teen pregnancy, and fetal alcohol syndrome. Tommy Orange was born and raised in Oakland and is an enrolled member of the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes of Oklahoma. He's a graduate of and now teaches at the Institute of American Indian Arts MFA program in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And he joins us by phone to discuss his novel, There, There, which was recently released in paperback. Welcome, Tommy Orange.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
And congratulations on the success of your book.
Thank you.
And of course, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation in about 20 minutes. We'll open our phone lines. I'll give you that phone number now. It's 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. So, Tommy, I'd like to have you start by reading from your book a passage from your prologue, the beginning of the section called Urbanity.
Great. I have that right here.
Great.
Go right in.
Go ahead.
Okay. Urbanity. Urban Indians were the generation born in the city. We've been moving for a long time, but the land moves with memory. An urban Indian belongs to the city, and cities belong to the earth. Everything here is formed in relation, getting a non-living thing from the earth. All our relations. The process that brings anything to its current form, chemical, synthetic, technological, or otherwise, doesn't make a product not a product of the living earth. Buildings, freeways, cars, are these not of the earth? Were they shipped in from Mars, the moon? Is it because they're processed, manufactured, or that we handle them? Are we so different? Were we at one time not something else entirely? Homo sapiens, single-celled organisms, space dust, unidentifiable pre-bang quantum theory. Cities form in the same way as galaxies. Urban Indians feel at home walking in the shadow of a downtown building. We came to know the downtown Oakland skyline better than we did any sacred mountain range, the redwoods in the Oakland hills better than any other deep wild forest. We know the sound of the freeway better than we do rivers, the howl of distant trains better than wolf howls. We know the smell of gas and freshly wet concrete and burned rubber better than we do the smell of cedar or sage or even fry bread, which isn't traditional. Like reservations aren't traditional. But nothing is original. Everything comes from something that came before, which was once nothing. Everything is new and doomed. We ride buses, trains, and cars across, over, and under concrete plains. Being Indian has never been about returning to the land. The land is everywhere or nowhere.
Thank you for that. Very, very wonderful reading. And that leads me to my intro question, which is when you talk about urban natives, urban Native Americans, urban Indians, what do you want your reader to understand that is similar or different than what they might imagine the experience of Native Americans to be?
Well, I worked in the Native community in Oakland for many years, and this term urban Indian became normalized for me, especially in the grant language and applying for grants and being a part of a team of people doing that. A lot of the language was urban Indian based. So I knew it was familiar. I knew it as familiar, and I also knew that it was the opposite of familiar to most people, including natives, and especially as far as depiction goes in books and in film, We've been mired in this historical image and this singular image. And so I was just wanting to represent something that I knew to be a very real world, and I knew that it was not just Oakland that had urban Indians, but every major city after the relocation ended up with Indian centers and urban Indian communities, which started way back in the 60s. So I was just wanting to sort of define or begin to define what that even means.
And what would you say are the connections between urban natives and those who live on reservations?
I mean, we all come from a very similar experience. The difference for people in the city being we may be disconnected from language and the land that, like, if you grow up on a reservation, you may have a better sense of community. And if you have a sense of community in the city, it might be an intertribal one and not necessarily tribally specific. So you might feel more connected to a specific tribal community if you're from a reservation, or you might not. That's not necessarily, doesn't go hand in hand. There's a whole range of experiences and proximities to Native identity and language and land, and people living in cities experience that same range of proximities as people on reservations in contemporary times.
And is there a dialogue, both literal and figurative, between those two experiences, the urban experience and the reservation experience?
Yeah, I don't think the communities would, the urban Indian communities would not be as strong as they are if the connections were not, did not remain from reservations. So when people came on relocation or for whatever reason, there was a lot of connections that remained. So you had people going back and forth, family members visiting and going back for ceremony or bringing ceremony here, or, you know, there's always remained a connection in reservations and cities because, you know, people had, their grandparents came from somewhere and there was family to visit on reservations if that was often the case. Mm. As a family, we went back to where my dad grew up in Oklahoma. We would go back during school breaks, and I saw it in my own family. We kept the connection, and my dad's living back there now, and my sister is as well, and my dad works for the tribe now. So it does happen, and maybe sometimes it doesn't, but in my experience, I definitely saw that dialogue happen.
Hmm. So for me, what that means is that one of the reasons that it's important to name the urban native experience is because you want to make sure to situate it, but also to kind of make it seen in a way that it might not be realized by the readers or the public.
Well, it's also kind of a statement about contemporariness because we haven't been allowed that. So if you just say it's a Native American person to the average American, they're going to immediately get a historical image in their mind, and that's really damaging to having a sense of place and belonging in now, and the issue that we should be having conversations about would disappear if people don't think in terms of contemporary Native lives. That's problematic. So the urban Indian does some work in redefining what we're talking about in terms of history or contemporariness. There certainly still is, or there are people dressing in a way that conjures the same feelings and images, but what this is just sort of a statement. The urban Indian, illustrating the lives of urban Indians, is just sort of a statement to counteract a lot of the problematic ways that we've been depicted in popular media.
And there's been a lot, your entire book has received a lot of acclaim, but there's been a lot of attention placed on the prologue to the book, which I'll encapsulate for the listeners. And, of course, please feel free to expound, which provides a historical perspective on the violence and oppression that has been perpetrated on Native Americans in the United States, and the assimilation and the so not only the history of it, but then the sort of the after effects of it. So to me, it sounds like history not only is important to make sure that you give a contemporary worldview, but that you situate it in a history so that it's very clear where we're starting from, or where the, your characters are drawing their experience from.
Yes, yeah. I think there's a way to gauge where somebody is in terms of the way they think of American history. When people react as if the prologue is audacious and has unbelievable violence in it, that says to me that you haven't really looked hard enough at what it's really been like, because to most natives, the prologue would not read as some kind of like exposing of history, or most natives know it did not go well and mm-hmm. live that experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting because your book kind of is very beautifully written, and there's obviously this part of you that I'm getting that had it set out in some ways, maybe not initially, I don't know, to kind of make sure you're setting the record straight in some ways, or making sure that there is a record that is accurate, that is being put out there for others to read and consume. I'm curious, did you have a motivation here to kind of use literature as a way to, again, to set the record straight, almost in a didactic approach here? I'm curious how much of that was part of your motivation or your planning for this book.
I don't think that doesn't feel accurate to me, and I think I've said set the record straight somewhere, but I don't think I was that deliberate. I think a lot of Native people experience history being taught wrong, and we live with that frustration. And when I was trying to contextualize urban Indians are, I found myself moving back in history. But I don't think I had a deliberation or like a political sort of aim in mind, or, you know, I wasn't thinking I need to tell everyone. I wasn't thinking in terms that everyone was going to read it. So I wasn't thinking there was going to be a record to straighten with some mass group of people, because I certainly didn't write it expecting it to have the reception that it did. So I think, you know, I was mostly just writing I wrote it in the we, the POV of we, and I was just trying to contextualize the lives of these Native people before starting their stories.
Mm-hmm. So tell us, let's talk a little bit more about the structure of the work and how you came to create a story that had 12 different perspectives, multiple voices in terms of points of view, first, second, and third person. What were some of the reasons you chose to do that?
Well, they kind of came out with different points of views when I first started writing it. And when I was structuring it and deciding on when I had all the chapters written and was trying to get the final structure in place, I played around a lot with POV because I wanted, as the reader went from one character to the next, one chapter to the next, I was wanting there to be a real distinction, because you're at risk for confusing the reader or blending, having voices blend and be indistinguishable when you have this many characters. So I was wanting to use POV as a way to really make the switch from one character to the next really distinct. I also just like what POV can do in terms of what angle you're coming at each world and each character from. So I experimented a lot with POV. I transposed a lot of the different characters into different POVs, which was super tedious, but I believed that it was going to serve some function while I was doing it.
So tell us a little bit about the plot here so that we can contextualize this for our listeners.
So the plot was sort of what came first before I even started writing it. The basis was a whole bunch of lives will converge at a powwow at the Oakland Coliseum. And so I knew that there was going to be a lot of characters, be a big cast, and a sort of cataclysmic ending. And the writing of it was trying to figure out how that could all work in an organic, cohesive way.
And so how much of this of the plot, so to speak, did you have figured out ahead of time? How did the characters emerge and present themselves to you, and were there characters that kind of rose up and then faded away? I'm curious.
Certainly. And I think the plot started, the specifics of the plot, because there's a robbery plan that you learn about in the first chapter. It sort of frames the book. The details around what exactly was going to happen slowly emerged over the 5 or 6 years of writing it until it all came together. But there were certainly many characters that came and were cut, some by me and then some later in the editing process.
And so, and then are these characters that speak to sort of a composite of people in your life? I know there's one particular character that you say is the most autobiographical, but how do you relate to the other characters in the book?
Well, they all resemble me more than they do any real people, aside from the Thomas Frank chapter, in which I sort of describe members of my family in a pretty autobiographical way. But otherwise, they're not really based on community members. Certainly, you can't stop composite experience from influencing fiction. Where else is it coming from? I mean, there is the imagination, but it's always based on some composite experience of one kind or another. But I made a point of not using people's real lives and turning them into fictional characters, because I feel the specifics of people's lives and their personal details are often hard-earned. And to it would feel like exploitation to sort of use somebody's life because it seems interesting, because it, you know. So I avoided using real people from the community. Aside from myself, I was pretty generous with using myself.
And how did that feel to put that on the page before a reader, to put yourself out there like that?
Well, I'm only in retrospect sort of revealing that. I knew because it's a novel, they wouldn't know what's fiction and what's not. So it feels like I'm exposing personal details, but they don't know which ones they are, so it doesn't feel as vulnerable. I'm not writing an autobiography, and I'm not saying this is me and this is what I did. So I'm not exactly revealing which parts are me.
So you talk a lot in the book about identity and authenticity, and how your characters are struggling with that. Tell us how that resonates with your experience, and maybe if you can contextualize it by telling us a little bit about your family of origin.
Sure. So my mom is white from Oakland. We go back 3 generations in Oakland on her side, and there's no specific part of that whiteness that, besides the American dominant culture, that really that we were taught directly. And then my dad is Cheyenne from Oklahoma, and he grew up in Oklahoma, and they met in the 70s in northern New Mexico at a peyote commune, and eventually ended up back in Oakland and raised us there. So I grew up with a parent who was white and a parent who was native, and as anyone of mixed heritage knows, there's the issue of identity is one that you struggle with, because you don't necessarily feel like you belong either one. And so that's definitely something that I experienced growing up. But I was also, since I grew up in Oakland, and specifically the street I grew up on, was full of biracial kids. It was also normal, and that made it easier. And most of the schools that I went to were pretty diverse, so a lot of people were dealing with identity and in various different ways.
And when you think about your characters, what would you say is the key question that they're struggling with that might sort of run through all of them?
I think I don't know that they all experience identity in different ways. I think the older generation doesn't really struggle in the same way that the younger generation does, and this is related to my experience with older generation natives not struggling as much with identity as the younger. And you know, you have young people growing up with the internet and very modern settings, and all that we see of natives as far as authentic natives in the way we see popular culture make them authentic just by representing them as that way all the time, it sets up this clash between, well, what does it mean if I'm supposed to be Indian and yet I play video games and ride a bike through city streets and I'm on the internet? It just creates this tension of well, what's going to make me a real Native person? So I don't know that they all struggle in the same way. I think I wanted to represent the many struggles of identity and how it's a thing for some and it's not necessarily a thing for others.
So sort of hearkening back to the fact that there's multiple shades of proximities to Native culture and that different people have different questions that they're grappling with when it comes to that.
Yes.
And then when you think about your own experience, then not only growing up where you did, but then in your work doing digital storytelling at the Native American Health Center, how did your own questions around identity evolve in meeting other natives, perhaps from an older generation, and how did that inspire you to look inside yourself?
Well, I don't know that I even identify with the younger generation that I'm writing about in terms of the struggle. It was always clear to me where I came from and who my people were. My specific struggle was related to, being from half and not belonging to either one all the way. But I don't know that I had some period of time where I more strongly identified because of being inspired by an older generation or doing digital storytelling. It was certainly strengthened by being part of the community in Oakland and being around a lot of different people that grew up in Oakland and strongly identified as Native. To feel like I was a part of something that was a real community, it certainly helped because I didn't necessarily grow up in the Oakland Native community when I was young. I worked in it in my 20s for almost a decade. When I was growing up, it was my dad and then going back home to Oklahoma, where we weren't always seen as, you know, authentic Natives in Oklahoma because people from there, they were all part of a community of Cheyenne and Arapaho people, and we were from the city. And historically, there's been a little bit more discrimination from reservation to city Indian. It's not the same anymore, but historically, there was more tension.
So Yeah, that sort of resonates with kind of what I was thinking about earlier in the conversation around, yeah, what are the areas of convergence and divergence when it comes to Native Americans who are living in very different geographical areas and therefore have very different experiences. I want to pause and reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing the urban Native experience with best-selling author and Oakland Native Tommy Orange, who's debut novel, There, There, came out in 2018 and has been recently published in paperback. We open our phone lines to you, our listeners, with your questions and comments. The number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. Tweet us or post a comment on our Facebook page. Are you a Native American living in the Bay Area? Have you heard of Tommy's novel? And if you've read it, what have you felt about it? And if you haven't, or you're non-Native and you've read it, we'd love to hear your experience of reading this work. 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. So let's go back to the structure of the novel, and specifically the themes actually that emerge here. A lot of the themes that your characters are dealing with are a lot of the themes that you talk about in the prologue: the assimilation, the violence, the histories of that precede people and have been, you know, part of their ancestry, and then current issues with domestic abuse and substance use, depression, unemployment, teenage pregnancy. These are pretty heavy topics, and they also, I imagine, the reality of what you want to write about, because this is the reality that is out there. How did you decide how to frame that for your reader, and how did you feel like this was going to take people down a path that is very, you know, hopeless and negative? Or where do you see hope in your characters? I imagine the perspective you come from as a reader has a lot to do with how you interpret the stories you're reading.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was wanting to make a connection between stuff like domestic violence and drug abuse and stuff that I've seen in my own family and in my community. I wanted there to be a clear connection between what's happened in history and what's happening now. Sometimes, I mean, we're living in a different time now, and people are a little bit more willing to look at the cause and effect nature of history in this country and what its origins are and what its current administration is doing and the nature of that spirit. I was wanting there to be a clear connection. In the past, I feel like Native people have been treated like lesser than because we're plagued by addiction because we're lesser than, not looking at, like, why might they be plagued by addiction, instead just looking at us as weak. And so I was wanting to make a clear connection between some of the modern things that we deal with and what we've been through and what our ancestors and even, you know, parents and grandparents experienced, and how that affects lives now. And how things aren't necessarily just, you know, that happened so long ago, who's to blame? You know, there's a line that runs from history to now that is a lot clearer and hotter than people think. Sometimes.
Right. So just really making the connection with root causes, and not seeing this as sort of an individual's behaviors that are somehow divorced from a context or a history that has created that. So to that point, though, where you know, a lot of people might see that and understand that connection, and the question is, where is the strength? Where's the hope that comes with that? I mean, I imagine that's something that readers want to see. Tell us about how you thought about, like, how much reality put in there, and how much did you want to make sure you kept your readers kind of connected in a way that felt hopeful.
I mean, I don't feel like a particularly hopeful person, and it's not a very good time to be feeling that way now. I don't know how much I was thinking consciously that I want to insert hope for the reader. And it doesn't end well. But I did want to make real lives and have the reader feel real love between the characters who love each other. Mm-hmm. And I wanted, by making something that's pretty dark, by trying to make it beautiful, that can create a kind of hope as mm-hmm. well. Mm-hmm. And in everyone trying to do things like celebrate at this powwow and find connections and reconnect with parents, these are all positive things that people are doing out of love, and there's always hope when there's love. If it's palpable and it's being acted out on the page, all those things, you know, can lead toward hope. But it's not a particularly hopeful book. Mm-hmm. That being said, a lot of the native reaction as compared to the white one, there's a kind of exuberance that people feel just at being represented and mm-hmm. just at being seen. I've heard this from many Native people who've come up to me, just like thanking me for being seen on pages that normally don't contain our lives. And I think there's hope there too.
So that the representation in and of itself is something to be celebrated, regardless of how dark it is, and the fact that, you know, why try to sort of water down what the reality is and the history that has led to that.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's talk a little bit about audience. I've heard some interviews that you've done before where you're really were saying you're not necessarily thinking about a particular audience in mind when you were writing this book, that you were thinking more of the experience of the individual reader what was going to engage them, what was going to help them to kind of continue to turn the page, and really kind of the sort of caretaking for the reader in the sense of wanting to craft something that was going to really connect them to the experience and to the book. But looking back now, and especially in what you're mentioning in terms of like the historical arc that led us to where we are today, do you see different audiences for this book, and what you're hoping each will get from it? And you said earlier, also, of course, sorry, I keep asking questions, you also said you weren't sure who was going to pick it up. So I'm curious how now in retrospect you see all of this.
If I had an audience in mind when I first was writing it, if the crazy thing happened where it actually became a book, I figured it would be the Native world. And I was, you know, when I was finishing the book, I was trying to become a teacher at my MFA program, and to teach at the MFA, you need to have a book published. So that was my goal. And I figured that my colleagues would read it if I publish a book, and, maybe students would read it. So, but I didn't. I don't have an audience in mind when I'm writing. I guess that's what you were referencing. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of, in terms of how to think of the audience now that I know that it's bigger. Mm-hmm. I want the reader to enjoy the book and enjoy the reading experience for the reasons why everyone loves to read. But I don't have anything specific that I want anyone to come away with. I wanted the Native world to enjoy it and to feel that it represents them well. And outside of that, and outside of the reader, wanting the reader to enjoy the book, as a novel, I really don't have any messaging or, you know, political aims in mind or ideas, specific ideas that I want any specific audience to go away with. That's not what I am here to do. Like, I really enjoy writing, and I love what novels can do, and writing short stories, and as much as literature can do, I'll continue to try to do that. But I'm not a very political person, even though that might sound funny because it seems like a very political book now.
Hmm. Well, I mean, I think the aspect of perhaps political could be the fact that you're making plain sort of what has happened to Native peoples over the centuries, and it resonates quite well with some of the struggles we're having politically in this country. So perhaps the timing may be what seems political, but it sounds like your intention wasn't. And especially since when you first started writing the book was 2012. So perhaps that wasn't a time of where you were thinking of necessarily what was to come. No one kind of knew that, obviously.
Yeah.
So I'm curious though, when you go to book readings and talk to people, whether it's native people or people who are trying to work against the current administration, do you feel like people are in some ways projecting onto you that, you know, you've brought a voice to something and now it's your job to kind of carry it forward, and that you have a sort of a responsibility that goes beyond what you originally set out to do?
Yeah, I mean, it's being a Native person, you're born into being political based on what's happened. And when I say I'm not a political person, I just mean it can be a charged thing. Mm. And like what I feel where my strengths are is in writing. And I wouldn't shy from writing something political. And certainly, I'm certainly against this administration, but I think that's just like the difference between a sane person and an insane person, not necessarily political. I do feel that just because I have voice, there is some sense of, but I haven't had any like anyone pressure me or ask me what I'm doing. There's been a little bit of like, what are you doing as an activist sort of feelings, and I try to just explain it like I'm not an activist, and that's not what I'm good at. Like I know how to write, and I'll try to, you know, represent whatever I'm writing about in a true way and in a way that is also enjoyable to read. But outside of that, that's not really what I'm here to do. Mm.
So let's go back to how you came to be a writer. What's your first memories of that?
I came to writing really late. I grew up more of an athlete. I was not a good student at all. I was a competitive roller hockey player. I don't know if you remember, but there used to be a pro team that played at the Oakland Coliseum called the Oakland Skates. Hmm. And I wasn't particularly encouraged to do anything academic or creative. So I didn't start writing or reading until my 20s. I sort of stumbled into fiction reading I was reading philosophy and religion, just kind of searching for meaning. I fell in love with fiction really late. And then I just remember knowing that it's what I wanted to do and reading and writing as much as I could to sort of play catch up.
And so how did you turn to that, if given that that wasn't something that was put in front of you, so to speak, or you weren't inspired by others to do it?
I graduated in 2004 with a degree in sound engineering, and this is right before the MP3 and the digital age sort of swept the analog age away. And most of my education was in analog recording, so my education became pretty irrelevant pretty fast. And I just got a job at East Bookstore because I needed to get a job somewhere. And I got a job at the Native American Health Center in Oakland at the same time. I was working part-time at both places. And I got a job at the East Bookstore. I'm not sure why. I think I was just looking in the classifieds or something. And I wasn't a voracious reader then. Like I said, I was reading for meaning and trying to figure out what ideas were out there that connected with me, because I grew up with a mother who raised us Christian evangelical, and I knew I didn't like that at all by then. So that's where I, and while I was working there, there was a lot of free time. It was a big bookstore, not very many people came, so I had a lot of time to even read while at work, and yeah, that's where I discovered fiction.
And then where did the writing emerge from?
It came pretty soon after. Once I didn't really know what a novel was, what fiction was, because I didn't like school. And so whatever I read, I was like skimming to pass tests, or like, you know, I was like a C student, pretty solid C student. I cared enough to pass a test, but not to excel. So the thing that made me fall in love with fiction and with the novel form, it came from the same place that made me want to write.
So let me introduce the program one more time. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing the urban native experience with Oakland native and best-selling author of There, There, Tommy Orange. We open our phone lines to invite you to call in with your questions and comments for Tommy. The number to dial is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us or text us at cityvisions@klw.org, tweet us, or post a comment on our Facebook page. So I wanted to follow up on what you said about searching for meaning in terms of a religious tradition. Where did that take you?
Well, I was just reading all of the major religious texts, anything from the Tao to the Upanishads, the Quran. You know, I was just searching what other people had thought about what all of this is, and I was reading, you know, Plato, Wittgenstein, everything that I could get my hands on, and, you know, not reading all of them all the way through, just kind of, like I said, just with the goal of finding something that made sense for me. Mm. That ended up being fiction.
And so you started reading in this way and writing in your 20s, and what did you think would come of that pursuit at that time?
I didn't have any goals as far as something coming of it. I wanted to get better at it. Mm. And I had had this background of playing hockey and playing sports my whole life, and then playing music. I became a musician, played guitar and piano. And with those, there's a very clear discipline that's like you put hours in on the court and you see the results. I had seen that. And you put hours into an instrument and practicing, and you can see the results or hear the results. And I sort of took the same approach because that's all I knew. My goal was just to become a better writer and to get to the place that I would feel like I'd gone from zero to whatever. I didn't like have an early goal of writing a book. I loved the novel form, and maybe dreamed that one day I'd try to write a novel.
And then how did you end up at the MFA program at the Institute of American Indian Arts? How'd you get there?
Well, that was about 9 years after I started reading and writing as much as I could. I just stumbled upon it. I was doing a storytelling workshop. I was working at a nonprofit called Story Center out of Berkeley, and there was a poet who had just graduated with her MFA, and she encouraged me. She found out that I got into this residency called McDowell, and I didn't really know that was a big deal, but she told me that it was, and she said I should go to an MFA, and she started Googling, and I was a young father, or I had a young son then, and I couldn't really just go to any MFA, so she looked up low residency MFAs, and this one popped up, and I saw the faculty, and it was affordable, and a low residency means you only have to go for a week and the rest is online. So that all seemed very practical, and it was also a book-based program, a two-year book-based program, and I'd already written more than half of the book. Okay. So it all seemed pretty ideal for my situation.
So let's go to a call. We have Anne from San Francisco. Anne, welcome to City Visions.
Hi. I'm curious, you said that you started reading novels when you were working in the bookstore. So three questions. First of all, what novelist do you like? And also, for what ages is your novel appropriate? And then last question, do you have any recommendations of novels for middle and high school students that would enlighten them about Native American, perhaps experience, perspective, issues? First, a novelist that you like that maybe influenced you to write.
Okay, well, I can just say there were a couple novels that I first kind of discovered what novels were and that I first loved, and that was Confederacy of Dunces by John Kennedy Toole and Sylvia Plath's Bell Jar. Mm-hmm. Sort of opened me up to what a novel could do, because it's What novels are, I think, is almost unidentifiable. You can create like a world and do almost anything in there,
of course.
As far as I'm concerned. I guess an early structural influence. I mean, Louise Erdrich, I think, would be the answer, the best answer I can give you as far as novels that are accessible to middle and high school students.
No, I was thinking about. That's your recommendation. You're saying.
Yes. But the people, other people that have influenced me along the way, there's a lot of authors that come to mind. I don't have any single ones I can point to. This question always blanks my brain out.
That's fine. Now, what ages do you feel your novel is appropriate for? What age?
I think it depends. As a teacher, you have a responsibility for kids with parents with different ideas. So
what are some of the issues? Is there violence? Is there sexuality? I haven't read your novel, so I don't know how about language?
I mean, I wouldn't want to recommend and regret, so it's just 18 and up, I'd say, I guess.
Excuse me?
18 and up.
And older, I guess. There's violence and there's bad language and there's some sexual stuff. And
so Common Sense Media, do you know if they've rated it or Goodreads? I'll check it.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if they have.
That's
Thanks
fine.
So much, Anne.
Sure. Bye.
Bye-bye. And we have Amy from Berkeley on the line. Amy, welcome to the program.
Yeah. Hi, Tom Lynch. I just wanted to say thank you so much for your incredible novel. Two
Thank
things.
You.
One is also I am so grateful. This is I taught public speaking at UC Berkeley to freshmen for a few years, and this is my first semester that I will be teaching this fall reading and composition class. And just for the audience to know that your book is the common read for all incoming freshmen for UC Berkeley this year, which is great. And the class I will be teaching is for, it's a small class of 10 to 14 students, about half of whom will be international students and probably the other half from underserved urban high schools. So that's exciting for me. So if you have any words for them, but I also wanted to say thank you so much for, without giving anything away, but you know, this means with a baseball bat. And I am a child who was at age 6 taken from my family because my father was in jail for the civil rights movement, and my mother, at that point my parents had split, my mother, who's Jewish, was living with a black man. So I so identify also with being taken away from one's family, raised in foster care and group homes. And had an experience so similar to that with Ronald, but my person was Roland, and I sat up in bed at 4 o'clock in the morning when reading that scene with the baseball bat and screamed, yes. So thank you for that catharsis.
Well, thank you for sharing that.
Great. Also, do you have, I'm just so excited to have your novel be the first novel that I will read with this small, intimate group. So any words that you would like to share for me as a first time reading and writing teacher, and also to a cohort of primarily international students?
I think encouraging them to write creatively and not worry as much about the composition. Make sure to like carve out time for creative, to have fun with writing, and you know, get to the rules of, because you have to, but like make sure that the fun's carved in.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Amy.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Grace in Oakland. Grace, welcome to the program.
Hi, this is Grace. I'm really inspired by the interview.
Thanks. What would you like to ask Tommy?
I just want to tell him that I'm so glad that he's written this book, because I was born Caucasian, but born very kind of poor, and have been out in this ghetto for a long time, and have seen so much, and befriended lots of natives and all kinds of people of all races. And it's just an amazing story that he's telling. And I think that's wonderful. I'm of the disenfranchised set who's educated but not. And I think it's great that he's able to speak, you know, on different sides of the whole issue. And that voice, Tommy, is so important that you're speaking it.
Well, thank you.
Thank you much, Grace. So that brings me, Tommy, to an email from Robert, and who asks, how has your relationship with Oakland changed since your youth? How is gentrification impacting Oakland's natives, and how do Native Americans create community in cities?
Well, I don't currently live in Oakland and haven't for a little while because it's so expensive. You know, there was a kind of a moment where me and my wife both lost our jobs because of a tribal leadership change. And then coming back, we've tried to come back several times, and it just has not worked out because of how expensive it is. Mm-hmm. So I've watched it more like a, you know, when you're in it, the gentrification is a little bit less loud, and it's a little bit slower. But because I experience Oakland sort of, it's sort of like a time lapse effect. I experience it at a rapid rate because I just see it on visits, and it feels a little bit more drastic to me these years that I've been gone. I certainly experienced it when I lived here, not so much in my youth, but you know, the years that between 2008 to 2015, I experienced it then, and there are different waves of it. As far as the native populations, it's not necessarily different than any other populations of lower class people who get pushed out by raising of rent and developers who buy up massive condos near BART stations, and that raises the rent, and all sorts of different practices that force people out. There's the native people in the city don't necessarily experience it in a different way, except that it's, you know, another form of colonization. As far as community goes, in most major cities that had relocation happen in the 50s and 60s started up Indian centers of different kinds, and there's often health centers as well, and this is often where you'll find community and people doing events, and Oakland has a healthy Native community.
So you talked about this. How much do you feel that Oakland is itself a character in this book?
Well, I tried my best to make Oakland feel like Oakland, the Oakland that I know and love, partly because it's not really represented very much in literature or in movies. We had Sorry to Bother You and Blindspotting come out the same summer as my book, and that was wonderful. So I definitely wanted to represent Oakland, the Oakland that I knew, and make it recognizable, and certainly I've heard people say a character, and that's great if it felt that way.
Hmm. And how do you see affinities between the native population in Oakland and other people like our last caller, Grace, people who are all struggling with issues of economic disparities, and how do you see their sort of convergences, and where do you see that there are differences when people say, wow, that resonated with me as a white person, as a poor white person, or a white person or that had a specific experience that's related in the book? How do you see the convergences and the divergences of experiences?
Well, I think anytime someone's resonating with something that I've written and feeling like it's speaking to their experience, I think it's a great thing if it's happening with literature. I think sometimes I hear the equivocation of class and race, and that to me is where the divergence is. Mm. Certainly there are similar experiences of what happens within lower class communities, but the power dynamics of race are different. It's just not equivocal. There may be similarities, but to experience racism on a systematic level is a completely different experience. And if you're a poor white person, there may be similarities, but you can't just equivocate completely that it's the same experience. So I think sometimes it's problematic when white people try to say, well, I'm exactly the same as you because I've experienced some of the same disparities in power and wealth.
So how has the last year changed who you are, if at all, or has it affected you to be the recipient of so much attention and focus and praise?
I mean, I think I have a lot more anxiety and I feel a lot more vulnerable and I don't necessarily like attention. I'm not trying to say that I'm complaining because I get to write for a living now and that's a wonderful thing. But it certainly may have made things complicated and loud in a way that I'm not that happy with. But if I can, you know, I like many aspects of it too. If I can help other writers get noticed, or if I can do well as a teacher, there are things that are good about it. But it's come with unexpected, you know, I never expected any of it to happen, but it's come with unexpected challenges that have not been all that fun.
Such as?
You know, starting the book tour, I was in a different city almost every day for 30 days, and every one of those days speaking to an audience of anywhere between 50 to like 300 people. And I'm someone who's always been terrified of talking in front of, even just speaking up in class. So to be, you know, writing is something that you do in private for somebody else to experience in private. So to turn into a public figure seems like a curse and not a blessing.
And how has the fact that you've discovered that there is an audience out there that is engaging your work to the extent that it is, and in a way you could never have imagined or predicted, how is that changing, if at all, or affecting how you, what kinds of projects you want to do next?
I don't think it is. I think I'm still doing, I'm writing the things I want to write, and I try not to let that kind of thing affect the writing that I do.
And if there's a aspiring writer out there, especially a native writer, what given your experience, what would you what words of advice would you give them?
I think reading and writing as much as you can, and really devoting yourself to the craft, is the only thing you can do. Not really doing it with the expectation that it's going to lead to becoming an author of note, but maybe just like finishing a book project. But really just like bettering yourself at the craft and devoting yourself to the craft with your hours and your attention. I think that's the best thing an artist of any kind can do.
Well, Tommy Orange, I really want to thank you for a very engaging conversation. And again, congratulations on your book, They're There Now, coming out in paperback.
Thank you. And thank you so much for having me on.
You're welcome. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang. Please join us next week for a discussion with human rights attorney and recent Mill Valley native mayor Jessica Jackson on her work in criminal justice reform. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.